You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for December 1st. I'm Joaquin White from Drake University. Here's our first story. And local news. The annual Red Kettle campaign supports nonprofit. The Salvation Army's iconic red kettles are outside stores around Council Bluffs for a six-week campaign to bring in about a third of the nonprofit's annual budget to support Pottawatomie County residents. Proceeds from the fundraiser support rent and utility assistance, youth programs, summer camps, and other Salvation Army initiatives. This year's goal for the Red Kettle campaign is $70,000. We are prayerful that with the great generosity of our community, we will reach this goal so we can better serve our neighbors here in Council Bluffs and the greater Pottawatomie County area. Lieutenant Melissa Christensen of the Salvation Army Council Bluffs said in a news release, volunteers can sign up to ring bells for two-hour shifts at registertoring.com. Donations can be made at Red Kettles around the town through December 23rd or at 715 North 16th Street. Cash, coins, and checks are accepted. Online donations can be made at council-bluffsredkettle.org. Council-bluffsredkettle.org. Moving on. Child Care Center honored as the healthiest in Iowa by Tim Rohwer. Rohwer. There's a picture going along with this. It is a woman holding an award in front of a door which has two birds on it. Amber Fry, it's captioned, Amber Fry, who owns a home child care center, recently won the Healthiest State Award in Early Care category. A local home child care center has been honored for its focus on healthy habits. Little Fries, located at 3020 Avenue M in Council Bluffs, has won the 2023 Healthiest State Award in the early care category. It's pretty exciting, said owner Amber Fry about this award, which is open to all child care facilities in Iowa. It's nice to know that all my hard work is paying off for something, quote. This isn't the child care center's first accolade from the program either. I was the runner-up, said Fry, who cares for about a half a dozen children. This contest is run by the Healthiest State Initiative, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization driven by the vision that every Iowan has the opportunity to live their healthiest life. The Iowa Department of Health and Human Services is among the sponsors of this annual event. Awards were given out in five categories, including K-12 and out of school, besides early care. Contest participants, including Fry, sent in written essays and videos about their facilities and the healthy practices performed. Her center's Facebook was another source of information for the judges. She added, there was much to be impressed concerning healthy practices at our center. Quote, we eat a lot of fresh food here, end quote. Fry said, quote, I'm a believer in fresh whole eating. I try to give them whole natural vegetables, quote. Pop and juice for the kids are a no-go, quote. I give them milk and water, Fry said. The parents love that, quote. The kids are taught to wash their hands before eating, plus the proper eating techniques with real silverware and plates instead of paper and plastic ones. Walking is another healthy habit the kids learn here. Being outside, being with nature is a big part of my child care, Fry said. We walk a mile a day, quote. There's also an outdoor garden in the back where the kids can help her with planting. Every winter was awarded a monetary prize to continue their work focused on improving the health and well-being at their site. Fry said her prize will probably be around $500, which will go towards paying an indoor greenhouse. We can't always plant things outside, she said. We'll plant seeds for the spring planting, but also grow microgreens and small root vegetables like radishes. We want to eat healthier, quote. That's not just for her family, but for the kids she cares for, she said. Fry is also involved in programs focusing on healthier lifestyles. Jamie Haberl, that's spelled J-A-M-I space H-A-B-E-R-L, executive director of the initiative, praised the work of Little Fries and all those who have won awards in this project. Quote, the hard work done by our annual award winners serves as an example for the rest of Iowa to follow to ensure a healthier future for the state, quote. Haberl said, I want to be a good child provider, Fry said. I want to go above and beyond. Giving Tuesday draws $3.1 billion this year. Headline by Thalia Beatty. T-H-A-L-I-A space B-E-A-T-Y of the Associated Press, New York. Nonprofit organization Giving Tuesday estimates that donors gave $3.1 billion this year on what has become one of the most important fundraising days of the year, the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. Donations were up $20 million on Tuesday, a 0.6% increase over the last year before adjusting for inflation, the nonprofit said. Giving Tuesday makes its estimate by drawing on data from donor management software companies, donation platforms, payment processors, and donor-advised funds. On the one hand, this is fantastic, said Woodrow Rosenbaum, Giving Tuesday's chief data officer. Tens of millions of people in the U.S. came together once again to have a huge impact for causes they care about, including donating an enormous amount of money in a 24-hour period. But the number of donors was down about 10% from 2022, which Rosenbaum called a worst-case scenario for the sector. We're seeing less dollars from the big donor that we've been relying upon and fewer grassroots donors who are so important to our resilience and long-term health of the sector. Nonprofit organizations and industry groups have been warning that donations this year are down, which follows a drop in overall charitable giving in 2022 for only the fourth time in 40 years, according to Giving USA. It's still too early to know whether end-of-year giving will pull charitable donations back up this year. Elaine Koenig, E-L-A-I-N-E space K-E-N-I-G, Chief Communications Officer at Vanguard Charitable, which hosts donor-advised funds, said about 30% of the total grant dollars donated from those accounts each year go out in the last 2 months of the calendar year. We absolutely lean into those traditional cycles of giving, which I feel like Giving Tuesday really capitalizes on, she said. But their account holders also responded with urgency to major events like wildfires that devastated Maui in August, Koenig said. Giving is the nicest thing to do and the best thing to do. And you get more from it than what you give, said Naomi Thompson, who works for a cancer charity in Northern Ireland, especially when donors feel like they have less to give, she suggested, really considering whether the organization's work makes an impact on the donors' community. Giving Tuesday estimates don't include gifts to mutual aid groups, donations to political organizations, or gifts made directly to individuals, Rosenbaum said. Still, the results may indicate further difficult times ahead. When we see this increase in average donation on Giving Tuesday, Rosenbaum said, we see that as a warning sign, not something we should be looking for. The picture associated with this article is a picture of the Utah Food Bank truck and people with packages and a car line giving those packages. The caption reads, Utah Food Bank volunteers load groceries for the needy at a mobile food pantry distribution site, December 21st, 2022, in Salt Lake City. This photo was taken by Rick Bowmer, B-O-W-M-E-R, of the Associated Press. ABC to start Oscars an hour earlier. Associated Press. Academy Awards enthusiasts won't have to stay up quite as late to hear the best picture winner in March. The 96th Oscars will begin 1 hour early, with the official show starting at 7 p.m. Eastern for the first time. ABC said Thursday. The official pre-show also will begin earlier at 6:30 p.m. Eastern. The show traditionally began at 8 p.m. Despite various experiments to keep the runtime to 3 hours, the broadcast sometimes stretched into the 11 o'clock hour. The Oscars are broadcast globally in more than 200 territories, and Film Academy membership became more international in recent years. Those involved in the show, from Film Academy to Network, have worked to get ratings back to pre-pandemic levels, making modest gains. Jimmy Kimmel is returning to host the show for the fourth time, with Raj Kapoor, R-A-J space K-A-P-O-O-R, serving as executive producer and showrunner alongside Katie Mullen and director Hamish Hamilton. The 96th Academy Awards will air live on ABC on March 10th from the Dolby Theater in Los Angeles. Nominations will be announced January 23rd. The picture featured with this article is Jimmy Kimmel speaking in front of the Oscars. That's not Jimmy Kimmel. The picture featured with this article is someone speaking at the 95th Oscars in front of the theater. The caption reads, Host Jimmy Kimmel speaks March 12th at the Oscars at the Dolby Theater in Los Angeles. The photograph was taken by Chris Pizzello, P-I-Z-Z-E-L-L-O, of the Associated Press. Court renews gag order in Trump's fraud trial. Ex-president regularly disparaged a law clerk. Others involved in case. Associated Press, New York. A New York appeals court reinstated a gag order Thursday that barred Donald Trump from commenting about court personnel after the former president repeatedly disparaged a law clerk in his New York civil fraud trial. The one-sentence decision from a four-judge panel came 2 weeks after an appellate judge put the gag order on hold while the appeals process played out. Trial Judge Arthur Engoron, E-N-G-O-R-O-N, who imposed the restriction, said he plans to enforce it rigorously and vigorously. Engoron imposed the gag order October 3rd after Trump posted a derogatory comment about the judge's law clerk to social media. The post, which included a baseless allegation about the clerk's personal life, came the second day of the trial over New York Attorney General's Letitia James lawsuit. Over the trial's first few weeks, Engoron fined Trump $15,000 for violating the gag order. The judge expanded the order, which initially covered only parties in the case, to include lawyers after Trump's attorneys questioned clerk Allison Greenfield's prominent role on the bench, where she sits along the judge. Santos Warren's expulsion would set a precedent. Republican lawmaker accused of lying, theft, vote expected Friday. Associated Press, Washington. A defiant representative, George Santos, refuses to resign and warned Thursday that his expulsion from Congress before being convicted in a court of law would establish a precedent that, quote, is going to be the undoing of a lot of members of this body. Republicans and Democrats offered resolutions to remove the first-term Republican congressman from New York, and the House is expected to vote on one of them Friday. A critical House Ethics Committee report released November 16th convinced more members that his actions merit the House's most severe punishment. The House Ethics Committee said it amassed overwhelming evidence of lawbreaking by Santos that was sent to the Justice Department. The report concluded flatly that he cannot be trusted after a months-long investigation into his conduct. The panel said Santos knowingly caused his campaign committee to file false or incomplete reports with the Federal Election Commission, used campaign funds for personal purposes, and violated the Ethics in Government Act concerning financial disclosure statements filed with the House. Pogues icon Shane McGowan dies at 65. Written by Jill Lawless and Dave Bryan of the Associated Press. Pogues, P-O-G-U-E-S, London. Shane McGowan, the boozy, rabble-rousing singer and chief songwriter of the Pogues, who's infused traditional Irish music with the energy and spirit of punk, died Thursday, his family said. He was 65. McGowan's songwriting and persona made him an iconic figure in contemporary Irish culture, and some of his compositions have become classics, the most notably the bittersweet Christmas ballad Fairy Tale of New York, which Irish President Michael D. Higgins said will be listened to every Christmas for the next century or so. It is with the deepest sorrow and heaviest of hearts that we announce the passing of our most beautiful, darling, and dearly beloved Shane McGowan, his wife Victoria Clark, his sister Siobhan, S-I-O-B-H-A-N, and his father Maurice said in a statement. The singer died peacefully, with his family by his side, the statement added. The musician had been hospitalized in Dublin for several months after being diagnosed with viral encephalitis in late 2022. He was discharged last week ahead of his upcoming birthday on Christmas Day. The Pogues melded Irish folk and rock and roll into a unique, intoxicating blend, though McGowan became as famous for his sozzled, slurred performances as for his powerful songwriting. His songs blended the scabrous, C-A-S-C-A-B-R-O-U-S, and the sentimental, ranging from carousing themes to snapshots of life in the gutter to expectedly tender love songs. The Pogues' most famous song, Fairy Tale of New York, is a tale of down-on-their-luck immigrant lovers that opens with a decidedly unfestive words. It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank. The duet between the raspy-voiced McGowan and the velvet tones of the late Kirsty MacColl is by far the most beloved Pogues song in both Ireland and the UK. Singer-songwriter Nick Cave called Shane McGowan a true friend and the greatest songwriter of his generation. Higgins, the Irish president, said his songs capture within them, as Shane would put it, the measure of our dreams. The story includes a picture of Shane McGowan singing by Michael Walter of the Associated Press. Former Pogues member Shane McGowan performs with the Popes at the 10th annual FLEAD, F-L-E-A-D-H, on July 10th, 1999, in Finsbury Park, North London. McGowan, the singer-songwriter and frontman of the Pogues, is best known for their ballad Fairy Tale of New York Has Died. Middle East. Truce continues in Gaza. Hamas, Israel, released more captives. Blinken Encourages Extension, written by Wafa Sharafa, WAFAASHURAFA, Jack Jeffrey, and Melanie Lindman. Deir al-Balah, Gaza Strip, DEIR AL-BLAH. Israel released another group of Palestinians prisoners early Friday after Hamas freed additional Israeli hostages under a last-minute agreement to extend their ceasefire by another day in Gaza. But any further extension of the truce, now in its eighth day, could prove more challenging, as Hamas is expected to set a higher price for many of the remaining hostages. Hamas freed six hostages hours after releasing two Israeli women Thursday afternoon. All were handed over to the Red Cross in Gaza, then brought to Israel for medical evaluations and to be reunited with their families, the Israeli military said. At least 10 Israelis a day, along with other nationals, have been released during the truce in return for Israel's release of at least 30 Palestinian prisoners. Asked why Hamas on Thursday released fewer than 10 hostages outlined in the agreement, the military chief spokesman, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, H-A-G-R-A-R-I, noted 12 Israeli citizens were released the prior day, implying the overall Israeli demands. A busload of 30 Palestinian prisoners released by Israel was welcomed home in the West Bank in the city of Ramallah hours later. R-A-M-A-L-L-A-A. International pressure mounted for the truce to continue as long as possible after weeks of Israeli bombardment and ground campaign following Hamas's deadly October 7th attack on Israel that triggered the war. The Israeli retaliation killed thousands of Palestinians in Gaza and more than three-quarters of the population of 2.3 million are uprooted, leading to a humanitarian crisis. Israel vows to resume the fighting once the ceasefire ends. The truce was set to expire early Friday, though internationally mediators were working to extend it. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other top officials on his third visit to the region since the war started, said he hoped the ceasefire could be extended and more hostages could be released. Blinken also said that if Israel resumes the war and moves against southern Gaza to pursue Hamas, it must do so in compliance with international humanitarian law and must have a clear plan in place to protect civilians. He said Israeli leaders understood that the massive levels of civilian life and displacement scale we saw in the north not be repeated in the south. Most of Gaza's population is crammed in the south with no exit, raising questions on how an Israeli offensive there can avoid heavy civilian casualties. Attitudes against fossil fuels build. Attendees okay funds to help poor nations hit by climate change, by Seth Bornstein, Associated Press. Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Pressure to phase out fossil fuels mounted Thursday on the oil company chief who took over fragile international climate negotiations that opened in Dubai amid concerns about what some say are contradictory dual roles. United Nations and climate talks leaders might have relieved some of the pressure with an early victory they called unprecedented. Negotiators unanimously approved contentious plans to launch and fund a new program to compensate poor nations hit by floods, storms, droughts, and other climate extremes. Several nations led by host United Arab Emirates immediately pledged more than $420 million for this new fund, which took 30 years to approve. Leaders say they hope that the quick win on a key financial issue would set a new tone for negotiations that put the climate talks' newly installed boss on the hot seat. Days before the start of the United Nations Conference of Parties, called COP28, reports published meeting preparation notes that linked efforts by the United Arab Emirates national oil company ADNOC, A-D-N-O-C, to push fossil fuel sales at the same time its CEO and new COP president, Sultan Al-Jaber, was meeting to fight climate change. The burning of coal, oil, and gas are chief causes of global warming. Al-Jaber vehemently denied the revelations from the BBC on Wednesday. More than 100,000 people were registered for the negotiations, more than double the previous high for these new UN talks. I think the pressure on the COP president to deliver is pretty clear and has been clear for months, German climate envoy Jennifer Morgan told the Associated Press. That's the focus here, to deliver on really a course correction. Meanwhile, the UN Weather Agency said Thursday that 2023 is all but certain to be the hottest year on record, and warned of worrying trends that suggested increasing floods, wildfires, glacier melt, and heat waves in the future. The World Meteorological Organization also warned that the average temperatures for the year is up some 1.4 degrees Celsius, 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit, from pre-industrial times, just one-tenth of a degree under a target limit for the end of the century as laid out by the Paris Climate Accord in 2015. COP28 President Sultan Al-Jaber speaks during the opening session Thursday at the COP28 UN Climate Summit in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. And that is the caption for the picture of Sultan Al-Jaber speaking. The photo was taken by Peter DeYoung of the Associated Press, or DEJONG. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for December 1st on IRIS, the IRA Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Joaquin White from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Again, that's 515-243-6833. Henry Kissinger, 1923-2023. Far-reaching influence is the headline. Five things to know about the former Secretary of State by Nancy Benack of the Associated Press. Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who died Wednesday at age 100, exerted far-reaching influence on global affairs under Presidents Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford between 1969 and 1977, earning both vilification and the Nobel Peace Prize. Here are five things to know about his life in government and beyond. 1. His portfolio. For 8 restless years, first as National Security Advisor, later as Secretary of State, and for a time as both, Kissinger played a dominant role in foreign policy. He conducted the first shuttle diplomacy in the quest for Middle East peace. He used secret negotiations to restore ties between the United States and China. He initiated the Paris talks that ultimately provided a face-saving means to get the United States out of a war with Vietnam. And he pursued Détente, D-E-T-N-E-N-T-E, with the Soviet Union that led to armed controls agreements. 2. His boss. Kissinger's power grew during the turmoil of the Watergate scandal, when the politically attuned diplomat took on a role akin to co-president to the week in the Nixon. No doubt my vanity was piqued, Kissinger later wrote of his expanding influence during Watergate, but the dominant emotion was a premonition of catastrophe. Kissinger told colleagues at the White House that the one person who kept Nixon, that drunken lunatic, from doing things that would blow up the world, according to Walter Isaacson, who wrote the 1992 biography Kissinger. His cachet, C-A-C-H-E-T. Pudgy and messy, Kissinger acquired a reputation as a ladies' man in the new STAID, S-T-A-I-D, Nixon administration. Kissinger called women a diversion, a hobby. Isaacson wrote that the Hollywood executives were eager to set him up with starlets, whom Kissinger squired to premieres and showy restaurants. His companions included Jill St. John, Shirley MacLaine, Marlo Thomas, Candace Bergen, and Liv Ullmann. In a poll of Playboy Club bunnies in 1972, the man dubbed Super K by Newsweek finished first as the man I would most like to go on a date with. Kissinger's explanation, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. His critics, four. Kissinger for decades battled the notion that he and Nixon had settled in 1972 for peace terms in Vietnam that had been available in 1969, and thus needlessly prolonged the war at the cost of tens of thousands of American lives. He was castigated for authoring telephone wiretaps of reporters and his own National Security Council staff to plug news leaks in Nixon's White House. He was denounced on college campuses for the bombing and Allied invasion of Cambodia in April 1970, intended to destroy North Vietnamese supply lines to communist forces in South Vietnam. That incursion, as Nixon and Kissinger called it, was blamed by Sub for contributing to Cambodia's fall into the hands of the Khmer Rouge insurgents. 5. His later years. Kissinger cultivated the reputation of respected elder statesmen, giving speeches, offering advice to presidents, and managing a lucrative global consulting business as he traveled the world. But records from the Nixon era released over the years brought with them revelations that sometimes cast him in a harsh light. Kissinger was dogged by critics, at home and abroad, who argued that he should be called to account for his policies on Southeast Asia in support of repressive regimes in Latin America. He had to think twice before traveling to certain countries to be sure that he would not be summoned by judges seeking to question him about Nixon-era action. Sports. Cowboys win in shootout with struggling Seahawks. Prescott throws for 3 touchdowns as Dallas extends home win streak to 14. By Schuyler Dixon, S-C-H-U-Y-L-E-R, Associated Press. Arlington, Texas. Dak Prescott threw for 3 touchdowns passes, and the Dallas Cowboys extended their home winning streak to 14 games, rallying for a 41-35 victory over the Seattle Seahawks on Thursday night. Prescott's 12-yard pass to Jake Ferguson put Dallas in front with 4.5 minutes remaining as the Cowboys set up a rematch with NFC East rival Philadelphia by escaping what would have been their first loss since falling to the Eagles 28-23 to start November. Geno Smith threw 3 touchdown passes to DK Metcalf, including a 73-yarder as the Seahawks got their offense going again, but Seattle couldn't avoid a third consecutive loss to drop to 500 for the first time since splitting its first 2 games of the season. Dallas's Braden Aubrey, A-U-B-R-E-Y, kicked 4 field goals to extend the 28-year-old rookie's NFL record to a 26 consecutive makes to start a career. Neither team punted, the 5th time in NFL history that's happened. But the Dallas defense, ranked 3rd in the NFL coming in, got 4th down on the Seahawks' final 3 possessions. as the Cowboys kept alive their best home winning streak since an 18-game run at Old Texas Stadium from 1979 to 1981. The Cowboys trailed 35-30 when Zach Charbonnet was stopped on 4th-and-1 from the Dallas 46. 7 plays later, Ferguson scored, and Prescott hit Brandon Cooks for the 2-point conversion. Cooks also had a touchdown catch in the second half quarter. CeeDee Lamb had the other touchdown catch while finishing with 12 catches for 116 yards, and his 24-yard run on a jet sweep helped set up Aubrey's final field goal to push Dallas ahead by 6. That came after Smith threw incomplete on 4th down near the midfield with 3:11 to go. The Seahawks reached midfield with 1:11 left, but Micah Parsons' pressure on 4th down forced Smith to throw the ball into the ground, sealing Dallas's victory. Metcalf had a season-high 134 yards on 6 catches in a second career 3-touchdown game, as the Seahawks scored touchdowns on 5 of their first 7 drives, coming in with 20 consecutive possessions without an offensive touchdown. Smith also ran for a score while throwing for 334 yards and an interception. There is an image associated with this article. Dallas Cowboys quarterback Dak Prescott celebrates after throwing a touchdown pass to Jake Ferguson, not pictured in the second half of Thursday's game against the Seattle Seahawks in Arlington, Texas. This picture is taken by Roger Steinman. It's Dak Prescott screaming in joy after doing something. Included in this article are brieflies. Bills. Buffalo linebacker Von Miller turned himself in to police in a Dallas suburb on Thursday after he was charged in a warrant with domestic violence against the mother of his child, who is pregnant, police said. Dallas police confirmed that Miller surrendered to police in the suburb of Glen Heights to face a charge of third-degree felony assault of a pregnant woman, which is punishable by 2 to 10 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. Jets. Aaron Rodgers fully intends to play again this season for New York, and he hasn't ruled out being back on the field for a game in a few weeks. The quarterback has been making a remarkably quick recovery since tearing his left Achilles tendon 4 snaps into his debut with the Jets on September 11th. Rodgers returned to practice Wednesday, the 3-month anniversary of his surgery, but he said he's not yet close to being able to play. He acknowledged he won't be 100% healthy if he returns less than 4 months after surgery, and added it wouldn't make sense to rush his return if the Jets are out of the playoff hunt. Browns. Cleveland rookie quarterback Dorian Thompson-Robinson remained in concussion protocol, making it even more likely Joe Flacco will start Sunday's game against the Los Angeles Rams. Flacco signed as a free agent with Cleveland as an insurance policy in case Thompson-Robinson struggled or got hurt. Cardinals. Arizona released veteran tight end Zach Ertz on Thursday, clearing the way for the rapidly improving Trey McBride to assume the starting role. Flex. The Eagles-Seahawks game in Week 15 has become the first NFL game flexed to Monday night. The league moved the Kansas City Chiefs at New England Patriots to 1 p.m. on Sunday to put Philadelphia at Seattle on primetime December 18th. The NFL also announced a triple header on Saturday, December 16th. The Minnesota Vikings will visit the Cincinnati Bengals in the early game. The Pittsburgh Steelers will play at the Indianapolis Colts in the afternoon, and the Denver Broncos and Detroit Lions will face off in primetime. Woods, PGA Tour. Woods has sloppy finish in his return. Associated Press, Nassau, Bahamas. Tiger Woods held up just fine Thursday in his first time competing in 8 months, except for limping at the end. That was more about his golf than his fused right ankle. Woods was holding his own at the Hero Roll Challenge until a double bogey from a bush on the par 5 15th, followed by 2 more bogeys. The result was a 3 over 75, 8 shots out of the lead, and a score better than only two players in the 20-man field in at Albany. Asked what he got out of his round, Woods laughed and said, "Hit a lot of shots." The British Open champion Brian Harman and Tony Finau, F-I-N-A-U, led the way at 5-under-67, one shot ahead of Jordan Spieth, who was as entertaining as ever. Spieth made only five pars and had one stretch of 10 holes without one until the final hole. But this day was all about Woods, as it usually is whenever he plays, and especially when he has been away for so long. He expected to be rusty, and it eventually it showed. I didn't have my feel, as Woods said. Conditions were tough early. I did not finish off the round like I needed to. Kind of went sideways at the end. He was 1-under for the round through 14 holes when he pulled his tee shot to the left at the base of the bush. He contemplating his options before deciding to punch it out towards the fairway or even a bunker, even though he could take the club back only a foot or so. Woods caught mostly soil and advanced it only a few feet. He punched his third shot back to the fairway and then came up about 40 yards short of the green. He pitched that to 10 feet only to miss the bogey putt. He found a fairway bunker off the tee on the tough 16th, came up short of the green, and hit a weak pitch to 20 feet that led to bogey. Then he three-putted on the par 3, 17th, from 45 feet. Woods wasn't the only player who struggled in his return. Will Zalatoris, Zalatoris, had back surgery right after he withdrew from the Masters. He had three double bogeys, a bogey in a four-hole stretch around the turn, and closed with one more bogey for 41. There is a picture associated with this article. It's a picture of Tiger Woods playing golf. Tiger Woods watches his shot at the third green during Thursday's first round of the Hero World Challenge PGA Tour at Albany Golf Club in New Providence, Bahamas. This picture was taken by Fernando Llano, or Lano, L-L-A-N-O, of the Associated Press. Movie review. Godzilla Has Amazing Longevity by Katie Walsh of the Tribune News Service. Back in 1954, just 9 years out from the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japanese filmmaker Ishiro Honda, I-S-H-I-R-O, and special effects designer Eiji Tsuburaya, E-I-J-I, space, T-S-U-B-U-R-A-Y-A, teamed up a giant dinosaur-like creature that came from the depths of the ocean, mutated by nuclear radiation, a kaiju named Godzilla. The monster was a metaphor for Japanese atomic trauma, and the film, produced and distributed by Toho, was a hit, spawning the longest-running film franchise of all time. Some 70 years later, the 33rd Toho Godzilla film, the 37th in the franchise, Godzilla Minus One, written and directed by Takashi Yamazaki, brings Godzilla back to its Japanese roots. The first Toho Godzilla film since 2016's Shin Godzilla, as well as its World War II roots. Taking place in the immediate post-war period in 1945, the film reckons with more than just the metaphorically monstrous nuclear fallout of the war, but also the devastating human emotions effects. When the monster surfaces glowing neon blue from the nuclear testing at Bikini Atoll, it unearths all of the repressed shame and trauma of Japanese veterans, specifically a failed kamikaze pilot Koichi Shikishima. S-H-I-K-I-S-H-I-M-A, played by Ryuno Suki Kamika Kamiki. RYUNOSUKE space KAMIKI. Shikishimi has already encountered Godzilla by this time. The monster stomps its way into Tokyo. During his failed kamikaze flight, he stopped on Odo Island for assistance, where the mythical creature came ashore to wreak havoc. Having already fled his mission, Shikishima freezes in the face of this monster, failing to shoot it and unable to assist his new friends, the airplane mechanics, who perish in the attack. 2 years later, Godzilla rears its head again from the ocean depths off Japan, mad as hell. Shikishima has now formed an unlikely family unit with Noriko, played by Minami Hamabi, and a young child, Akiko, played by Saki Nagatani, who was orphaned in the bombing of Tokyo. He's been working with a crew to clear mines from the ocean floor, and they are conscripted into tangling with Godzilla, who has been chomping through heavy cruisers and blasting them with atomic heat rays before heading to shore to wreck its way through a Tokyo still struggling to get back on its feet. This scrappy crew aboard this wooden boat will remind audiences of Jaws, and will the Japanese government's unwillingness to warn citizens about an impending threat, much like the mayor of Amity Island in Spielberg's Shark movie. There are other references to Jaws, like the deep sea fish that bubbles to the surface as a harbinger of Godzilla's arrival, and Yamazaki has said that he was inspired by the film. Yamazaki's script does reckon with the lasting effects of World War II in Japan, and while the nuclear mutation of Godzilla is part of the plot, the themes of Godzilla Minus One are focused more on the Japanese government, including their failure to protect its citizens from this threat, as well as oppressive imperial regime that pressured young men into suicide missions during the war. It's a group of private naval vets who end up taking on Godzilla, not the government, while Shikishima struggles with his own shame around failing as a kamikaze pilot and failing to stop the monster back on Odo. It's not until he can fulfill his mission that he can be free of his shame, and it takes Godzilla's destructive arrival to bring that into focus for him. Yamazaki's take on Godzilla is classical, utilizing the giant kaiju as a metaphor for social commentary. An aesthetic take is classical as well, combining a retro 1940s style with cutting-edge visual effects for one of the most striking Godzilla monsters we've seen in years. The way its craggy fins break the surface of the ocean is almost photorealistic, and when Godzilla's atomic-powered glowing spine burst with power, it's breathtakingly beautiful. The picture associated with this is a picture of Godzilla. Today in history. Today's highlight. On December 1st, 1991, Ukrainians voted overwhelmingly for independence from the Soviet Union. On this date, in 1824, the presidential election was turned over to the U.S. House of Representatives when a deadlock developed among John Quincy Adams, Andrew Jackson, William H. Crawford, and Henry Clay. Adams ended up the winner. In 1862, President Abraham Lincoln said his second annual message to Congress, in which he called for the abolition of slavery, and went on to say, "Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves." In 1941, Japan's Emperor Hirohito approved waging war against the United States, Britain, and the Netherlands after his government rejected U.S. demands contained in the Hull Note. In 1942, during World War II, nationwide gasoline rationing went into effect in the United States. The goal was not to as much save on gas, but to conserve rubber that was desperately needed for the war effort by reducing the use of tires. In 1952, the New York Daily News ran a front-page story on Christine Jorgensen's sex reassignment surgery with the headlines, XGI becomes blonde beauty. In 1955, Rosa Parks, a black seamstress, was arrested after refusing to give up her seat to a white man on a city bus in Montgomery, Alabama. The incident sparked a year-long boycott of the buses. In 1965, an airlift of refugees from Cuba to the United States began, in which thousands of Cubans were allowed to leave their homeland. In 1969, the U.S. held its first draft lottery since World War II. In 1974, TWA 514, a Washington-bound Boeing 727, crashed in Virginia after being diverted from the national airport to Dulles International. All 92 people on board were killed. On the same day, Northwest Orient Airlines Flight 6231, a 727, crashed near Stony Point, New York, with the loss of its three crew members. The plane had been chartered to pick up the Baltimore Colts football team in Buffalo, New York. Entertainment briefs. Waititi only made Thor because he needed cash. Taika Waititi only directed Thor Ragnarok because he was poor. The 48-year-old filmmaker has helmed two movies in the superhero franchise, but explained how he had no interest in working in the Marvel Cinematic Universe and did so only support his children financially. On the Smartless podcast, Waititi said, "You know what? I had no interest in doing one of those films. It wasn't on my plan for a career as an amateur, but I was poor and I just had a second child and I thought, you know what, this would be a great opportunity to feed those children." Waititi also suggested that Marvel reaching out to him implied that they were unsure about what to do with the franchise. He explained, "I think there was no place left for them to go with that. I thought, well, they called me. This is really bottom of the barrel." Around the NBA. Report, James partner bet on NBA. Maverick Carter, LeBron James' business partner, told federal investigators that he bet on NBA games through an illegal bookie, the Washington Post reported Thursday. Carter made his remarks during an interview as part of an investigation of bookie Wayne Nix, according to the Post report. It said Carter could not remember placing any bets on the Lakers, the team James had played for since 2018. Carter and James, the NBA's career scoring leader, are friends from Akron, Ohio, who together own Spring Hill Company, an entertainment and production company. The Post reported that Carter told investigators he placed approximately 20 bets on football and basketball games over the course of a year, with each bet ranging from $5,000 to $10,000. A spokesman for Carter and James confirmed the interview occurred in 2021. Mr. Carter was not the target of the investigation, cooperated, was never charged, and never contacted again on the matter, spokesman Adam Mendelsohn, M-E-N-D-E-L-S-O-H-N, said in an interview provided to the newspaper. And that brings us to the end of today's rating of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for December 1st. The Daily Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Joaquin White from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Goodbye.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland, and is used today around the world, and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.